I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. 2016, the presidential campaign so far can look like a nervous breakdown or a populist breakthrough or both. Nobody I know has seen or felt anything like it. It's been fabulous theater in the opening acts, featuring a primal scream in Iowa and New Hampshire from the new young working class. But what sort of an exercise in democracy are we talking about? This hour is a pause in the action to consider what choices people are actually being asked to make. What do they want? What do they know? What are they saying? And who's listening, just for starters? Everybody's question in the anxious republic is, how can sovereign people, free people, change a nation's directions? The provocation in our studio to find an answer is Michael Glennon. He's a worried lifer from deep inside the national security bunker. His headline going into this presidential campaign was, "Vote all you want, the secret government won't change." National security and double government is the title of his dense and depressing short book. His argument and his hundreds of footnotes elaborate a very common suspicion out there, with right-wing and left-wing versions, the basic notion that our famous checks and balances, our adversarial, open, elected, and constitutional system is by now a sort of folklore. The top secret government is the real one. It's efficient, tough-minded, full of good enough people with a lot of sins and crimes and failures to answer for, but they answer to no one, including the president, the Congress, and the courts, and the people. Michael Glennon, welcome to Open Source. Introduce these people. Who are they? What kinds of people? What do they think they're doing?
Well, Chris, thank you very much for having me here in the studio today. They are several hundred individuals who sit at the top of the national security bureaucracy. They are a network of very dedicated public servants who run the intelligence, military, and law enforcement agencies that are responsible for maintaining the nation's security and meeting internal and external threats. Who are they? They're very smart, hardworking, dedicated experts who work 24/7 jobs in almost complete secrecy. They can't talk about their work for the most part with anybody, including their families. They tend to support the status quo because their bosses, in part, were responsible for creating the policies that they carry out, hence the strange continuity in national security policy that you were just noting from the Bush administration to the Obama administration.
These people, they've got a plan for the next president, whoever it is. Let's talk about the Bush to Obama continuities, as you say. Guantanamo, drone warfare, this draconian pressure on journalists, on leakers, on whistleblowers. So much hasn't changed. How does that work? And they tell people, I mean, they tell the president what he's going to do. And President Obama is quoted in your book, and you didn't make it up. He tells his staff, by the way, guys, the CIA gets what it wants. How does this happen?
Well, that's a quote, actually, from Mark Mazzetti's book. And it pretty well summarizes the hands-off policy that the president, not simply this president, but other presidents as well, have towards not just the CIA, but the NSA, the FBI, and other elements of the intelligence and law enforcement community. John Kerry, when it was revealed that Angela Merkel's phone was being tapped by NSA, said, "The program is on autopilot." Autopilot is a very good one-word summary for these programs. Why are they on autopilot? There's a whole set of incentives that lead to deferring to the experts who run the national security apparatus. No president, no legislator, no judge wants to have another attack occur on his or her watch. No one wants the blood to be on his or her hands. Therefore, the incentive is to defer to the experts. And if they tell you that a national security letter has to be sent or a drone strike has to be launched or the state secrets privilege has to be invoked in a given case, you tend to defer to them. So the president ends up being more presider than decider, as I say in the book.
So many instances, so many marvelously revealing lines. We used to see it on television, George H.W. Bush, and I always noticed his left hand was always chopping when he would say it. I was out of the loop. I was out of the loop. It was a rote thing about his role in Iran-Contra. But as if to say, that wasn't our level of, you know, the top political leadership. It was those guys. But they all say it in different ways. Leon Panetta saying, no Democratic president, capital D Democrat, no Democrat in the White House can go against military advice, especially if he asked for it. How did that play out, say, in President Obama's decision to go deeper into Afghanistan when he could have wrapped it up?
The president's staff complained repeatedly that he was boxed in by the Pentagon. He was presented with options that were illusory. He typically would be given three options. The two bracketing options, the first and the third, were unreasonable, and the Pentagon's preferred option was in the middle. And Obama would ask the Pentagon to give him more options, and they'd add a fourth option that was also unreasonable. And his staff, as you suggest, came to the conclusion that they were playing him, and Obama himself became quite resentful. And this is a situation, mind you, in which the president is personally deeply involved, unlike many of the other national security decisions, such as tapping foreign leaders' phones, where the programs are on autopilot.
It goes into law enforcement, too, on these decisions, for example, of who will or will not be punished for certain things. Edward Snowden may live the rest of his life abroad because he told critical secrets, truths about NSA surveillance. The people who did blatantly illegal things of all kinds, including killings for the CIA in torture in the Senate, in the Feinstein Senate report, they will not be punished. These are decisions made at some deep secret level too, are they not? I mean, another example, President Obama takes a good deal of heat from the journalist side for a really mean policy on disclosure, on press, on leaks. Is this his idea? Nobody can quite believe that this is Obama talking. Who's telling him, we've got to send a signal here?
It's hard to know in all these situations where the ideas came from. Many of them percolate up from the bureaucracy. President was reported to have read in the New York Times the first time that his administration invoked the state secrets privilege, something that he criticized as a senator in the campaign. And it's true, no one has been prosecuted for torture. You know, President Obama has said we tortured some folks. He said that he considers waterboarding to be torture. We did execute Japanese war criminals at the end of World War II for engaging in precisely the kind of waterboarding that was done under the name of the United States in Afghanistan. No one has been prosecuted. In fact, the only person who's been prosecuted, so far as I can tell, in connection with the waterboarding of the CIA has been the CIA officer who originally publicly revealed it, which the agency was not happy about.
I mean, the context here is a campaign season, which shows you sense a tremendous public appetite to get real about an awful lot of things, and they're going to be insistent about it. But we're not talking about, I'm not sure we want to hear what the people would say about torture, about the drone war, about a secret military establishment. But what might we be talking about on the hustings?
We might be talking about who's accountable for these things. And I go back to what you just referred to, the Senate Intelligence Committee's report on torture. There's no indication of who was accountable, no indication of who violated the law, no recommendation of any reforms. That's what we ought to be talking about.
There's very scant mention even of the price tag on the war in Iraq, the price tag on all sorts of things, the casualties, ours and theirs. I mean, the casualties in the drone war that we've inflicted on Pakistan begin to approach the numbers of dead on 9/11. But again, that's not what we talk about ground games in the Trump campaign. We don't talk about policy. Michael Glennon is our guest. His book is called National Security and Double Government. Coming up, the origins of this security state in Harry Truman time between World War II and the Cold War, 7 decades ago. But on the way, a view of where the system could be headed. This is the NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, who's still in a lawbreaker's exile in Russia for fessing up to the secret and oft-denied surveillance of American citizens.
The greatest fear that I have regarding the outcome for America of these disclosures is that nothing will change. People will see in the media all of these disclosures. They'll know the lengths that the government is going to grant themselves powers unilaterally to create greater control over American society and global society. But they won't be willing to take the risks necessarily to stand up and fight to change things, to force their representatives to actually take a stand in their interests. And the months ahead, the years ahead, it's only going to get worse. A new leader will be elected. They'll flip the switch, say that because of the crisis, because of the dangers that we face in the world, you know, some new and unpredicted threat, we need more authority, we need more power, and there will be nothing the people can do at that point to oppose it, and it'll be turnkey tyranny.
This is Open Source. Michael Glennon teaches international law at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. For years, he watched the inner workings of the national security state as legal counsel to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He's written a very pointed notice to citizens in an election campaign that the people have lost already, that the secret government will tell the next president what he's going to do and not do. From NBC television back in the day, this was a bit of John Chancellor's documentary on the CIA in its boyhood.
Much of this, for Americans, begins and ends in this building located at Langley, Virginia. This is the headquarters of the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States government. Everybody knows it, although the sign on the gate reads Bureau of Public Roads. Secret cubicles, computers which translate Russian to English at 30,000 words an hour, documents burned in a $100,000 furnace.
That was a long time ago, Michael Glennon. You laugh, but survey the territory of that institution today.
I didn't know that the furnace cost $100,000, I must confess. I've never seen it.
You would have ordered a dozen.
Jeez. I thought they just had regular fireplaces over there. Well, the whole apparatus, I should say at the outset, is, you know, there are many conspiracy theories about it. Deep states and invisible governments and silent coups. Nothing like that's happened. That's really quite ridiculous. The whole thing has been evolving in plain sight, and it was all set up in open sight by President Harry Truman in the early 1950s and late 40s. Truman was concerned about the emergence of the threat from the Soviet Union and didn't want the United States to be caught flat-footed, and so he supported a number of what were thought at the time to be reforms. He established the CIA in 1947. He put together the National Security Council. He, in 1952, issued a secret executive order setting up the National Security Agency and consolidated the military leadership to try to end internecine warfare among the different services. And that whole apparatus has, as I suggest, come to dominate the formulation of national security policy today.
Your book is a fascinating reminder that in those days, in the late 40s, it was the conservative Republicans who worried about a garrison state, including, that was the phrase of one-time speaker, Joe Martin from Attleboro, Massachusetts.
That's right.
But Bricker, even Robert Taft, they were very, very skeptical about sort of creating a military monster here.
Yes, I was quite surprised by that. In researching the book, I had no idea that it was, in fact, conservative Republicans in the late 1940s and early 50s who were concerned, as they said, about establishing an American Gestapo and moving to a garrison state, creating a slave state. They were concerned about power-hungry bureaucrats at the Pentagon who were interested in padding their budgets and expanding their manpower. And it was the liberal Democrats like Hubert Humphrey and Paul Douglas of Illinois who defended what
the Cold War liberals.
Doing. That's right, on the theory that it was necessary to meet the Soviet threat. So the politics were just completely inverted from those today.
But the fascinating thing, and others have written about this, is that Harry Truman, out of office, and he was not a great fan of John F. Kennedy, but after the Kennedy assassination, he wrote an extraordinary piece in which he was ready to undo the CIA. He thought he might have created a monster. He said the spy agency, his handicraft, had become an operational and at times policy-making arm of the government, a peacetime cloak and dagger operation far removed from its intended role. Well, Kennedy was gone, and Arthur Schlesinger always maintained that he had said it should be CIA, which had snookered him into the Bay of Pigs, should have been, you know, torn up in a thousand pieces and scattered to the far winds. But I don't know, was that ever conceivable?
I doubt that it was. I think at some point it might have been possible to do what Truman was recommending, and he wrote that very prescient letter or op-ed piece for the Washington Post 1 month to the day after President Kennedy was assassinated, very curiously. It didn't get much play, but Truman's proposal was basically to get the CIA out of the operational business. He said that CIA was created. He created the CIA to try to eliminate the confusion from different intelligence agencies giving him conflicting advice. He wanted someone to vet it all and cause it to be coordinated. So his suggestion was, if we're going to do these things, it shouldn't be an intelligence agency. Maybe the Pentagon ought to be doing it. So this, of course, was not followed, and we lived to regret it not long afterwards. In the mid-1970s, as you know, Frank Church headed a committee that finally started to get to the bottom of the sorts of abuses that Truman hinted at in that op-ed piece, but we're still pretty much kept from the American people.
People have forgotten Senator Frank Church, always described as the boyish senator from Idaho, kind of a choir boy, but a tough investigator and a very I mean, he was the one who revealed not just the CIA, but the dark side of Camelot too. Judith Campbell Exner. He was a good investigator and very tough about it. Here's a snippet of Frank Church, and I want you to remember him for us. But here he is digging deep into all sorts of things the CIA was up to, assassination plots, secret wiretapping. On Meet the Press, he worried about the runaway technology, then primitive, but of spying. This was 40 years ago. Listen.
At the same time, that capability at any time could be turned around on the American people. And no American would have any privacy left, such as the capability to monitor everything, telephone conversations, telegrams, it doesn't matter. There would be no place to hide. Now, why is this investigation important? I'll tell you why. Because I don't want to see this country ever go across the bridge. I know the capacity that is there to make tyranny total in America. And we must see to it that this agency and all agencies that possess this technology operate within the law and under proper supervision so that we never cross over that abyss. That's the abyss from which there is no return.
Before that same Frank Church subcommittee, Michael Glennon, there was this one of those nice moments illustrating the way the secret government speaks now and then with its constitutional overseers, but it doesn't say much at all. The committee had the super spy James Angleton on the stand, and the question was why the CIA was intercepting civilian mail from Moscow, including letters from well-known Americans. Listen.
What counterintelligence objective was it thought you were achieving in opening the mail of what most of us would assume to be very patriotic, thoughtful, decent Americans?
Sir, I would prefer, if possible, to respond to that question in executive session.
We don't talk about that stuff in public, Michael Glennon, but you can, and you can sort of evoke the conscience of Frank Church.
Well, I'll tell you, it just came out a couple of years ago that when Frank Church spoke the words on Meet the Press that you just played for the listening audience, his international phone calls were being intercepted by the NSA. He was being spied upon by the NSA. I don't believe he knew that at the time. And when it did come to light, the current Senate Intelligence Committee, of course, was completely indifferent about it and did nothing about it. But I would like to think that if Frank Church were alive today and chairing that committee, the result would have been a lot different.
Among those choice quotes that you're scattered through your book, there's a very sort of poignant one from George W. Bush. I forget who it was, but he was asked, what was the big surprise of your 8 years in office? And he said, how little authority I have.
Yes. Isn't that interesting? You think of him, he likes to think of himself as the decider, but in all honesty, he acknowledges to his staff that he's really not the decider at all. He's a captive of events, and really in many ways a captive of the bureaucracy that we've been talking about. You know, the Senate Intelligence Committee did suggest that he was very seriously misled by the CIA on the issue of torture. He has since suggested that he approved it, but the suggestion in the report is that the agency never told him how egregious the torture was that was being visited upon these detainees. And one has to wonder whether he didn't take the bullet for the agency retrospectively rather than approving it in advance. Maybe Cheney approved it in advance, but I wouldn't be surprised if Bush did not know about it.
Stick with the Church Committee for a moment. Who subverted their message? Why did that? You know, I'm thinking actually of an analogy with Alan Dulles's role in the Kennedy assassination investigation. People looking at it soberly now don't see it as the Warren Commission. They see it as the Alan Dulles Commission. And in many, many ways, the Fox was investigating the chicken coop or his own work. Who was the lessons of the Church Committee undermined by the secret government, including its friends in the press?
That's a very interesting question. Lots of people, including Les Aspin, who was a member of the House at the time, went on to become the Secretary
Clinton
of Defense.
Clinton's Secretary of Defense.
Believed that the turning point came when the CIA station chief in Athens was assassinated. I think it was in 1977. The Church Committees had, as you recall, recommended a series of reforms, including the enactment of charters for the FBI and the CIA, which would lay out their authorities and set out very specific and explicit limits on their power. It turned out that the CIA station chief, just as the Church Committee was building up some momentum, was assassinated. And the CIA made a great effort to blame this on the Church Committee. In fact, the CIA director, George Bush, the first George Bush, later to become president, came before the Church Committee and explicitly said that it was their fault, which was, of course, ridiculous.
How could it have been? What would have?
Well, it couldn't have been. That was the point, as the members had pointed out. There were tour bus tours in Athens that pointed out that this was the house of the CIA station chief. There was nothing in anything that the church committee said that would have led the people who were behind this murder to any evidence that it was he. And President Bush subsequently did apologize to the committee because he made an unjustified accusation. But in any event, as Aspen pointed out, the return of the casket of the station chief, Richard Welch, his name was delayed until prime time so that the landing of the plane at Andrews Air Force Base could be covered on national television. And the common sentiment was to blame the congressional overseers for this tragedy. And from that point on, Frank Church was playing defensive ball, and the momentum behind the intelligence reform movement was lost. So I think that was the turning point.
Interesting. And then everything changed in a different way after 9/11, when, as the CIA put it, the gloves came off intelligence and interrogation, and Vice President Cheney, no less, choosing his words, I think, very carefully, told Tim Russert on Meet the Press just what the government would no longer talk about.
I want to be careful here, Tim, because I clearly would be inappropriate for me to talk about operational matters, specific options or the kinds of activities we might undertake going forward. We do indeed, though, have, obviously, the world's finest military. They've got a broad range of capabilities, and they may well be given missions in connection with this overall task and strategy. We also have to work, though, sort of the dark side, if you will. We've got to spend time in the shadows and in the intelligence world. A lot of what needs to be done here will have to be done quietly, without any discussion, using sources and methods that are available to our intelligence agencies, if we're going to be successful.
That was Dick Cheney, Vice President, and maybe George Bush's real master, saying an awful lot without saying anything or saying nothing, but laying out the whole rationale. Can you parse that language?
Well, I think it's a couple of things struck me listening to that. First, I was reminded of the conclusion of the 9/11 Commission, looking back on this tragic attack on the Twin Towers and the Pentagon. The question arose as to what role the intelligence committees played and should have played. And the 9/11 Commission came to the conclusion that intelligence oversight in the House and the Senate was dysfunctional. That was the word that the committee used, that the 9/11 Commission used, dysfunctional. And we never really, as a result of the commission's findings, did anything to improve congressional oversight. So, you know, you fast forward into the later years of the Bush administration in this torture program, you got to ask, what if we had taken that seriously? Maybe the committee would have engaged not in hindsight but of oversight and learned what was going on and visited the black sites and done something to stop these crimes, but it didn't. And the second thing that it struck me listening to Cheney is that he really captured something about the times in his reference to the need to take steps that we can't talk about concerning sources and methods. There's this mystique about what I call the Trumanite network, the national security state, that it has so many abilities that are beyond the powers of normal men, kind of filled with supermen who are able to execute solutions that are beyond the capacities of other military. We know from our history that this is nonsense. Nonetheless, there's this mystique that is built up, and it now includes the military as well as the intelligence communities. And even people like Madeleine Albright, sitting at a table, turn to someone like Colin Powell because he has a uniform on and say, Colin, why do we have this splendid military if we're not going to use it? The instinct is to think that military solutions are more effective than diplomatic and political solutions. And it's an understandable impulse because the military is so proficient and so widely respected in our society. But ever since 9/11, we've really downplayed alternatives to military and intelligence initiatives.
The Cheney phrasing is such a marker of its time. All that sort of theatrical menace, the growl, the Darth Vader sort of feeling about it, but also the enforced silence, like, don't ask, and we're not going to tell, just sit there and you'll see eventually. I mean, it brings me back to a question that we keep asking ourselves. Will we ever, will this country, will this culture, will us as people ever get over 9/11 and the intimidation and the denial and the obfuscation that all came with it? In a word, and we'll come back.
It's a suggestion that you ought to be afraid and take our words for it. We're doing the right thing.
Coming up, another 50-year career man, Leslie Gelb, looks back in sadness on what he wrote and didn't write for the Pentagon, for the Council of Foreign Relations, and the New York Times. This is Open Source. We are speaking early in a presidential campaign year about a central pillar of the state that people and politicians and the press, even presidents, walk pretty meekly around. That is the vast military and intelligence apparatus born in the Cold War, still expanding in a new time, especially after 9/11. My friend of many years, Leslie Gelb, has watched the security network for a lifetime from key outposts of it in the Pentagon, in the Congress, at the top of the Council of Foreign Relations, and at the New York Times, where he covered the CIA and the State Department. I asked him this week to generalize about what links and drives that establishment in the military, the media, and the think tanks.
In all three worlds where I've lived, ideology, that is the current set of beliefs, whether it's anti-communism or anti-terrorism, whatever it may be, and politics were always a central part of my life and the lives of people in the foreign policy business. If we were living in the anti-communist era, almost everybody in the foreign policy establishment was, to varying degrees, anti-communist. And the need to fight and stop Russia and China was sort of a central ingredient of everything you thought and you wrote and said if you got on TV or radio. If you were considered too far left or left at all, you were murdered politically, made it very, very difficult to get confirmed by the Senate. So sure, ideology and politics were central to the foreign policy establishment.
Let's go from 1950 into the new century. You've watched this thing in extraordinary detail. A report card, please. How's it doing?
Well, I don't give us a very good report card for most of these years, because we got involved in major covert or overt wars that didn't really make any sense. Now, I say that, as you know, Chris, as somebody who supported some of those wars. So I'm not innocent, nor is the foreign policy establishment. Foreign policy establishment, with very few exceptions, supported all these wars. And it's not as if we knew what the devil we were doing. Take Vietnam. You know, I ran the Pentagon Papers Project.
Thank you.
As I went back and looked at some of the intelligence reports from the 1950s, 1955-56, our experts in China were writing reports saying that Vietnam's biggest enemy was not the United States. Vietnam's biggest enemy, North Vietnam's biggest enemy, was China. And if you really knew about Vietnam and Indochina, knew that part of the world, you'd know that for centuries upon centuries, that was a fact. But we didn't know anything. We didn't know that history. We ignored what the intelligence community said. When I was in the government during the Vietnam War years, I was a principal draftsman of Robert McNamara, the defense secretary's memo to the president. I had read one book about Vietnam, Bernard Falls, The Two Vietnams.
Yeah.
That's about all anybody read. That's what we knew about the place, that we were about to invest 550,000 men in arms and lose, you know, 50,000 men. And
you have to say where we were about to kill 2 million people who belonged there. Yes.
Absolutely. At least 2 million. And without even knowing what we were doing, without even knowing about the place. It was a square on the strategic chessboard to the United States, to the foreign policy establishment. It wasn't a country with a history and a culture.
You speak of the establishment as we, Les. What drove you, us?
Well, what drove me is, you know, my expertise and my being part of that foreign policy community, because I shared the way of thinking about problems, and I lost my full sense of questioning, challenging, which really is part of my nature. But I accepted this way of thinking. You know, take the Iraq War. For the first few months, I was for the Iraq War. And here are the reasons. One, I went to people inside the Bush administration who had access to the intelligence, and they flat out assured me they had very high confidence that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. Secondly, and combined with this, Saddam had used chemical weapons against his own people, the Kurds, and against Iran when he invaded Iran. And he invaded Iran. And he invaded Kuwait. So he seemed, in this way of thinking, to be a real danger. But, you know, we got panicked into saying, all right, go get him, rather than saying, let's see if we can get him, since he knows we're serious about invading this time, to open up and let us fully inspect. I think there was a good chance that might have happened. But you see how the push was to go in there. There were people in the foreign policy community who challenged it, but they were few in number and quite brave.
Who do you think of?
Well, I think of Steve Walsh, John Mearsheimer.
Les, as you speak, I think we need experts on us. Looking at our own history, our own character, our own impulses, we're the mystery to me.
Well, we are, especially because we've done a lot of good in addition to all the harm we've caused.
Yep.
When this country did what I thought it was founded to do, that is to be a country that allowed freedom and decisions based on common sense, on pragmatism, that was a hallmark of America. That's what allowed us to make this country into the greatest country in the world, and it is. And it was built on common sense and pragmatism. And when we come to a lot of these public policy issues, where is that common sense? Where is that pragmatism? They're gone.
Les, when we first spoke, you said in so many words that there are people and institutions here that ought to be on trial. What's the charge, and who do we put on the defensive here?
Well, I think the national security establishment has from time to time committed criminal acts in the narrow sense of the word that is punishable by courts, by law, and in the broader moral and philosophical sense of needlessly causing great harm. We invaded legitimately elected governments in Central America and then later had to face guerrillas there during the Reagan administration. We overthrew Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran in the mid-50s, was legitimately elected prime minister of that country. And then we, you know, forever turned lots of Iranians against us. They said, look, we behaved democratically, and what did you do? You got rid of the guy and brought back the Shah. We made the mistakes in Vietnam I talked about, the mistakes in how we handled Afghanistan and Iraq and so forth, not knowing about these places. You know, one of the great paradoxes of America, Chris, is that we are the ultimate country of immigrants. There's never been a nation like ours. We're a nation built on immigrants. And once they come here, they have amnesia about the countries they left. So we don't know about the world. These are all foggy places to us.
Yeah.
But, you know, that said, we did prevent the Soviet Union, which was a very dangerous country, from just walking over a good part of the world. And eventually, we defeated that Soviet Union. That was a big deal. It was a big accomplishment. And after years of ridiculously trying to stiff-arm China, we eventually opened up relations with them, too. And that's a big deal. We were the leaders with foreign aid and various kind of assistance to countries. And we did promote democracy in places like South Korea and Taiwan and Turkey. So we've done some good, too. But at the same time, the harm I've described has been there and has been very costly.
That was Leslie Gelb, now retired journalist, policy dude, Council of Foreign Relations chief. Michael Glennon is our guest. Michael, what do you hear there? I mean, a man of your generation looking back on so much misjudgment, including his own, a lot of his own.
Well, I think he's put his finger, as he often does, on the ultimate drivers of these mistaken policies. First, the ideology and politics that he accurately refers to is driven not only by fear, not only by this sense of emergency that is created first by communism and now by the terrorist threat, but also, as he points out, by ignorance, by political ignorance on the part of an electorate that has lost its sense of pragmatism and common sense, and by elected officials who have what Senator Fulbright famously referred to as the arrogance of power, mm-hmm. as the refusal to acknowledge the limits of their knowledge. And think of some of the initiatives we've undertaken in recent years, the invasion, the use of force against Libya with our NATO allies. Did we really understand the tribal divisions in Libya before we undertook this? Did we understand that it was entirely possible that we could create a new safe haven for Al-Qaeda that would require much more aggressive intervention, which I gather the Obama administration is now considering undertaking? I don't think so. And Les is finally right in analyzing the intense peer pressure that is placed on members of the foreign policy establishment to go along, because not to do that causes you to look weak. There's a tremendous dynamic of groupthink in the
pressure on journalists too, and that's to me the saddest mm-hmm. part of the whole thing. Let me say, when we weren't recording Les Gelb, he was the chagrin in his voice was still deeper. I mean, this is a man looking on 50 years of American history and saying, where was I? He's also, as I am, just so distressed about journalism. We have to tip our hats to people like Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras of that the movie about Snowden. But you can't help wondering where, you know, is there a David Halberstam on the landscape, a Neil Sheehan, really the great reporters of Vietnam who took on the government and their papers back in New York? That was not easy. In your book, you quote Halberstam on Sheehan, but they were speaking for both of them. When they came away from Vietnam with one impression, that the government of the United States was not what they had thought it was. It was as if there were an inner U.S. government, what Sheehan called a centralized state, far more powerful than anything else. It had survived and perpetuated itself, not for the benefit of the republic, but for its own ends, for its perpetuation, which is the great theme of your story. Speak of civic virtue. In the founding, in the Madison days, long before the Truman days, civic virtue was the absolutely necessary condition of in which a constitutional government could work. I mean, there was something in the people. I don't believe that as Les Gilbert was saying, that common sense and pragmatism have left our people. We're very practical people in so many areas of our life. What would it take to get that accountability, that kicking the tires, questioning authority, back onto the campaign trail, even this year when a lot of people are in a tear about what their government does across the board?
That's a hard question, and I think the last time you saw that kind of civic engagement generated and driven by information and an informed citizenry probably was in the late 1960s and early 70s. And look at the wonderful members of Congress that were elected by that energetic citizenry. It occurred because there were three very broad and deep social movements, one on top of the next: the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and the Vietnam War, and then Watergate. So you had three layer upon layer of members of Congress who reflected that sense of public duty. But that was the Madisonian ideal. That he said the Madison and his colleagues believed that the system would not create an equilibrium of power unless you had a virtuous citizenry who were engaged and informed, who elected members of Congress and a president who were committed to the public good. You would not get ambition counteracting ambition absent that all-important predicate. And today, unfortunately, as Justice David Souter said, the reality is pervasive civic ignorance. Pervasive civic ignorance. Those are his words.
Well, that's what Les Gelb was talking about. In this super smart expert security state, too, there's profound ignorance. He'd read one book on Vietnam, and he was writing Secretary McNamara's testimonies. And he, as he says, Iraq, Afghanistan as well, Libya, as you're saying, the monumental not knowing about this country. How long can we excuse ourselves? Oh, we didn't know. Robert McNamara thought Vietnam was a Catholic country because it had a Catholic puppet government left over from the French. It was a Buddhist country. He knew better. He should have known better than that. You wonder why we don't hold ourselves even now to a much higher standard.
Well, this is the ultimate problem with the Trumanite network and the national security state. We don't hold them to any standard, and democratic accountability has largely dissipated as the result of the dominance of the executive agencies and departments, and the demise of power on the hands of the elected representatives of the people in Congress, and the courts checking out of the whole set of disputes.
So, I just got to put in a hopeful thread, though. There's a deep generational split here, and the kids, forgive me, are of a different mindset. A, they're out of work, and they're burdened by their college debts, and they're kind of desperate. But they're also, strangely, I think they're ready to call a spade, but they're also, as people keep reporting, they're strangely optimistic. Give us a chance. Give us a chance to look it over, and don't give up on American common sense.
This is an important point to end on, Chris. You know, I've suggested that it's pretty futile to try to change national security policy. National security policy is very different from health care or environmental regulation or economic disparity. These are areas where political engagement can make a difference, and I hope these young people are not discouraged.
Got to end with your line from the great Thomas Jefferson. If a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. Let's learn about some of those places. Thank you, Michael Glennon. Thanks also to Leslie Gelb. Please come and comment and listen to our first two shows on Campaign 2016 on our website, radioopensource.org.
Our show this week was produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, and Abby Duker. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.